cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take.
Let's set your Business Week agenda on this. Yeah, it's kind of a Fed Wednesday. We call it an FOMC Fed Wednesday because, as Charlie mentioned, definitely market reaction, yields dipping down a bit, and we are definitely seeing a pop up in the equity trade. So let's get to it with our markets team. Molly Smith is economics editor at Bloomberg News. She's on the phone in New York City. Kriti Gupta, anchor and markets correspondent at Bloomberg News. And Kriti, before we get into a deeper market analysis, just talk about the reaction to those Fed minutes, if you would.
Yeah, so the stock market here, and remember, we are on extremely low volume, down about 17% from its five-day average. The stock market has popped on these headlines, up about 0.6% on the S&P 500. NASDAQ now higher by above 1%. I should say it was kind of meandering for most of the day. So a very strong positive reaction in the equity market, a positive reaction for the bond market as well. The 10-year yield, 3.71, down about 4 basis points. And even a drop in the VIX, we are now at a 20-handle on the VIX. We have not seen that since this past summer. Also, a little bit of weakness in the dollar as well. I'm going to let Molly kind of go through these headlines here. But to me, I think the one that they're most reacting to is that several officials said continued rapid tightening risked destabilizing financial markets. Mm. Destabilizing, not a great word. And of course, they also talked about, in light of the turmoil in the UK, a really precarious situation.
We're going to be obsessing about this for a while. Molly, come on in on it and just break down what jumps out for you in terms of those FOMC minutes.
Yeah, to me, this reads pretty in line with expectations and echoes a lot of what we've heard in the time since the policy meeting earlier this month. A lot of what Powell had said in the press conference of expecting a higher peak rate, which most participants did agree with in the minutes here. And also, a theme of what most of the Fed speak in the time since has been in the sense of soon being appropriate to slow the pace of tightening. So I think that's also pretty positive for market drivers here in, more solidifying those bets around 50 basis points for December.
Yeah, Molly, I think you're right. You know, it sounds very similar to what Jerome Powell said at the last press conference. And it really seems like the market is keying in on that notion of slowing the pace of rate hikes and sort of ignoring the idea of the terminal rate being a little bit higher than what we had thought before the last meeting. I mean, is the Fed sort of just kind of buying themselves some time with this type of stance, saying, look, we could raise rates to ultimately higher than what everyone expected, but we're going to do it more slowly? Is that kind of the takeaway, do you think?
That seems like a fair assessment. They know that they need to be hiking, well into the first quarter of next year, possibly into the second quarter, and that seems like what several Wall Street banks are predicting as well. And it's a lot of the data this morning would also support the idea of slowing the pace. We saw a few reports this morning that generally just pointed toward slowing parts of the economy, and most notably with the labor market starting to cool and continuing jobless claims being the real indicator of that, as in people who are more routinely filing for unemployment claims and a sign that people are being out of work for longer. That is obviously not great for the people who are applying for unemployment benefits, but in the Fed's mission right here to try to cooled the labor market and softened demand more broadly, that is a very good indicator.
Can we call this a pivot? Creedy, I'm going to first get your take and then go to Molly.
I don't think it's a pivot just yet.
Why not? We're now talking about maybe
Michael
slowing
McKee gave me a very big lecture. He said, you can't call it a pivot until they're actively cutting
rates.
Well,
you can do whatever you want.
A downshift, right? A downshift.
It's a step down.
AKA a pivot?
A step down. I'm going to do that before Mike gets McKee in trouble. I've got to say that to me, I mean, look, I completely agree with everything Molly is saying, but I think what's really crucial, once again, is look at what they're saying here, that the risk of leverage in non-bank institutions could amplify the shocks. That's kind of some scary stuff. There's some pretty scary language in here. Destabilizing the financial system.
What do they mean by non-bank institutions specifically?
I think so. This is like anyone that's not your market makers, your JP Morgans, okay, your Goldmans, your
FTX.
Yeah. I'm just going to say crypto, anybody? That won't be at the Thanksgiving table, although I bet there'll be discussions among family members. Molly, is this a pivot?
I'm going to stick with Creedy's assessment here and my good friend Mike McKee.
Oh, come on. You guys are chickens.
No one ever wants to argue with McKee.
Yeah, you can't agree.
No, I think, if any of us start saying it's a pivot, then the S&P is really going to go through the roof today. So I'm not going to call it a pivot for risk of destabilizing the market.
But there's definitely a change, significant change. Could we call it a pivot in the tone of what the Fed is saying, Molly?
I like downshift. I really do. I think, and the thing for me is what pivot implies is that it's a stark turn away from what they've been communicating. And to me, this has been what they've been communicating. This is very much in line with what we heard at the meeting earlier this month and what several Fed speakers have been communicating to us.
All right, we got to go. All right, we can continue to debate this. In the meantime, do my Twitter poll on your favorite pie for Thanksgiving. Molly Smith, economics editor at Bloomberg, Kriti Gupta, anchor and markets correspondent at Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
The minutes from the last Fed meeting, as you just heard, they're out just about 18 minutes ago. And I feel like the big takeaway for me was that the Fed did see officials talking about a slower pace of hikes appropriate soon. But they also talked about a somewhat higher than they had previously discussed federal funds rate, the ultimate level of the Fed fund. So I feel like there's something for everyone in this report. Let's bring in Steve Skanke. He's chief economic advisor over at Keel Point. He is a former U.S. Treasury and White House National Security Council staff member. He is based in Washington, D.C., and that's where we find him via Zoom. Steve Skanke, so nice to have you here with Mike Regan and myself. Is it true that there's maybe a little bit of everything or something in this report for everyone a little bit?
I think that's a good assessment, Carol. There's nothing that's really surprising here. We had a dovish statement at the end of the November meetings, and then we had a somewhat hawkish commentary from Chair Powell in his press conference, which was delivering the notion that they may have to raise above the 4.5 to 4.75 percentage points. As the top rate of Fed funds that was indicated in their September summary of economic outlook. So, yes, a little bit dovish, a little bit hawkish, no big surprises from what we've been hearing already.
You know, Steve, when I look at the stock market react the way it did to this these minutes, you know, S&P's up about 0.5 percentage point, and we have the end of the year coming. A lot of investors sort of assume there'll be some sort of seasonality that leads to a year-end rally in stocks. Does that, do you think, influence the Fed the next time they go out on the speaking circuit to the point where they might walk some of this dovishness back a little bit if they're afraid that financial conditions are loosening up too aggressively?
Oh, no, they never talk it back, Mike. They never, right, Dr. Skanke?
Mike, that's a great point. What's interesting is that there was enough dovishness in it, in their policy statement, and even in Chair Powell's press conference. And then we got this great inflation news, the October CPI, the PPI last week, and markets just started to basically rejoice in what was good news, that the Fed actions were working, they could lighten up. The things that they said about a slower pace in these circumstances would allow the committee to assess progress towards its goals of maximum employment and price stability. It seemed like that was being achieved. And of course, the FOMC members got unnerved about that. And so last week and even earlier this week, you heard a lot of pushback on that. They certainly don't want irrational exuberance to set in. But at the same time, a good number of them recognize that they've done a lot pretty quickly, and they really need to take time to reflect to see how that's working out so that they don't overdo it.
So do you feel like when you look at the subsequent data points that we're getting, as you mentioned, the inflation print, but even like the weekly jobless claims today, right? Weaker than expected, showing some slowing down of the labor market, still very high historically in terms of the strength that we are seeing. But that's a good sign, at least from the Fed's perspective.
That is a good sign from the Fed's perspective. And the jobs number that we expect for November at the end of next week looks like it's going to be below 200,000, more in the range of 175,000. Wage growth also seems to be slowing. All good things, because one of the recurring themes in their minutes, as we just looked through them, is angst, concern about tightness in the labor market. And so some of the labor information out today, out earlier this week, indicates that it's becoming less tight. It is slowing. That's helpful as an early indicator of avoiding what the Fed is afraid about, and that is that inflation just gets built into the labor market and very hard to root out.
Yeah. Steve, the other big takeaway from these minutes is as the Fed is sort of laying the groundwork for less aggressive rate hikes going forward, they're simultaneously sort of, you know, prepping the market for a higher terminal rate, you know, the higher peak rate in the Fed funds rate. I'm looking at the what the Fed fund futures are implying, and they're pricing in basically about a 5% peak in the Fed funds rate towards the middle of the next year. Does that sound about right to you?
That sounds about right. And right after the meeting, Mike, Fed funds futures were up at 5.10 and change, which was where the Fed, I think, was pointing them. And then, of course, with the good inflation numbers, that dropped back to, you know, 4.8. And now it's, as you say, it's back up about 5%. It's also a bit of a race as to which gets to 5% first, the Fed funds rate or inflation. Chair Powell implied, though he didn't say it explicitly at his press conference a couple of weeks ago, that they sort of see 5.10 as, which was, of course, their SEP inflation rate by their personal consumption expenditures inflation metric.
Right.
That they were going to get there.
Got it.
And of course, the market accordingly. But you know, inflation is coming down more quickly than they had thought.
Steve, we got to run. Have a good Thanksgiving. Steve Skanky over at Kiel Point. This is Bloomberg.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, this story definitely jumped out at me reading in this morning. It's a Bloomberg opinion piece. It's about the real reasons your family is sick right now. And basically, it's about how wearing masks for more than 2 years drove down the incidence of colds and flus, the viruses that causes that. And as a result, we lost immunity, something that the popular press, Mike, has dubbed immunity debt.
Immunity debt. I guess
fits into our world, huh?
Yeah, right. Wonder if there's credit default swaps on the immunity debt.
It feels like a new asset class. Right. All right, so let's get to our next guest, see what he has to say. He's a friend of the program, Dr. Ian Lusbader, clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone. He is on the phone in New York City. Ian, good to have you here with Mike and myself. I got to say, this is why I continue to wear a mask on subways, in public places, while flying. Tell us about all the stuff that's coming at us right now.
Absolutely. First of all, happy Thanksgiving, Carol and Mike,
too.
And hope it's a good holiday. So, yeah, so although many people enjoy the holidays and feel very positive, there are both emotional and health risks to it. A lot of people feel somewhat isolated, depressed, anxious, but in addition to that, they're worried about potential risks from what we're seeing now are multiply infected people, both kids and adults, with a combination of influenza, and for that we do have a vaccine, so it makes sense to get your flu shot, even though it's not 100% effective because of mutations. It usually provides some protection. So influenza, RSV, as you said, respiratory syncytial virus, which we tend to see more in kids, but you can also see in adults, and of course, based on age, can have more complications. COVID, which hasn't gone away, although it does seem to be a little less serious. So we're seeing patients often with a combination of all of these, and even other viruses like rhinovirus and adenovirus. So we are in this kind of soup of viruses, and even kids going into the hospital, friends of mine who are in the ICU out in Long Island say when they test kids with these pathogens, this nasal swab, often they come up positive on a multitude of these viruses. So, you know, what do? Do you invite everyone over? Do you wear, you know, how can you wear a mask when you're all sitting down?
Yeah.
So masks certainly can help a bit, but obviously not practical. And you really have to evaluate your risk.
Right.
You know, if you're older, if you have diabetes, if you have lung disease, you know, maybe sit it out this year. Maybe make your guests take a COVID swab before they come in.
Be smart, right, basically.
You know, be smart about it and emotionally prepare. In other words, try not to take things too seriously, be relaxed, but make sure your guests are healthy before they show up.
Doctor, is there anything we can do about this quote-unquote immunity debt? You know, if our immune systems are sort of weaker now than they were before COVID, is the old, you know, taking vitamin C or drinking orange juice, is there anything to that? Is that worthwhile precaution at this point?
Definitely vitamin D plays a big role, and most people are vitamin D deficient. So definitely most people, and you can check your levels and see where you are, although there is a big range. I think vitamin D supplementation makes sense. To some degree, zinc prevents attachment of viruses. So being in good health, in general, losing weight, exercising. So all of that makes sense. It is less clear that the fact that we haven't had as bad a flu outbreak makes you more vulnerable to the flu next time. I think that's a little unclear, right? Because if you're taking a vaccine or you're wearing a mask, are you doing yourself a favor or not if the next round of flu you're more susceptible to? I would say that it does make sense to take precautions. There's some evidence that the shot helps. I don't think that it makes sense that if you haven't had some illnesses that you're necessarily more at risk. Most of us have had RSV growing up. Huh. Most of us see a lot of viruses, but they mutate from year to year.
I think vitamin D, Carol, is best achieved through the sun, right, doctor? So I'm going to take this prescription that we should be in the Caribbean for the holidays, it sounds like.
Here, here.
It's good, but you can't live there. And in New York, because you're in a northern climate, the sun is at a very shallow angle. So some sun exposure is good also for the mood, because we know that increases mood. There's seasonal affective disorder. When it gets dark early, people get depressed in addition. Right. Probably one of the reasons the holidays are stressful.
Dr. Lesbader, right, exactly. We're all getting ready for that stress that comes with the holidays. Maybe we'll talk about that next time. Ian Bewell over at Dr. Ian Lesbader over at NYU Langone Medical Center.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Right now, we want to talk a little bit more about the crypto crash, something we talk about a lot. Yesterday, we did that with ARK's Kathy Wood, which if you missed that conversation, check out our podcast feed. It's also on the Bloomberg Terminal. I have to say, though, when it comes, Mike, to the crypto crash, continues to evolve and play out every day. One angle, I'm not sure if you caught it, is about how crypto's crash is actually helping couples rekindle their relationships. Who knew?
Yeah. Not true of the journalists and editors covering this FTX collapse, I will say. I think my wife's tired of hearing about all this.
It's kind of been nonstop,
right? And the late nights. But at least someone is a happy ending for someone,
Mike,
out there.
No more SBF. No more SBF. All right. So let's get to this story, which you can find online at Bloomberg.com/Businessweek. It's also on the Bloomberg Terminal. Let's bring in Bloomberg Businessweek contributor Joel Stein. He is on the phone in Los Angeles. And Pat Regnier, markets and finance editor at Bloomberg Businessweek via Zoom from New York City. Pat, I got to say, in all of our crypto coverage, I kind of missed this one. I'm so glad you guys are on it. How did it come to your attention, Pat?
Well, you know, I think I'll let Joel talk a little bit about the people he knows, but I think all of us who've spent any time reporting on crypto got to know people for whom crypto became kind of a defining part of their lives. I mean, a lot of the people listening to this are just ordinary finance workaholics who have a hard enough time sort of paying attention to this stuff, when the markets are open. But crypto has this quality of never being closed, even on the weekends, and bringing a lot of things outside of people's peripheral vision. And I think a lot of people have had a hard time kind of emotionally managing that. And the side effect of that is that it's hard on people's relationships. But Joel, tell me how you kind of came on to this. These were some people you knew.
Yeah, it's my friend Igor Hiller, who's in the piece. And he was the guy I always called when I ever got assigned a crypto story to ask him, like, the basics of, like, what the hell this was all about. And he was over for dinner with his longtime girlfriend. They've been together for, like, 4 years. And they told us a kind of, like, what started out as a really funny story and turned really kind of sad and serious, where they almost broke up.
Wow.
Because he wasn't paying any attention to the relationship because he was so obsessed with his crypto buds and hanging out with them and just checking his phone constantly and waiting for NFT drops and just, like, you know, degenerate gambler. Maybe you'd call it degenning when he went into these kind of phases. And she kind of gave him an ultimatum that it was either crypto or her.
But, you know, Joel, you mentioned those NFT drops, and I get the impression reading this that NFTs almost really worsened this situation because you're stuck there waiting for these things to drop and they can be delayed. Did you get that sense too that, you know, the addiction was almost worse when it came to NFTs, both because of the time consumption and also sort of the potential upside in those as an investment, at least for a hot minute there?
For a hot minute, NFTs were, but throughout the entire, you know, crypto cycle, there was always a different thing that could occupy you 24 hours a day because crypto markets don't close. So during the DeFi farming phase, there was always some new farm that was opening up that you had to get involved and get their coin real quick. Or there'd be a coin drop, right? Like, people were creating new coins all the time. And Elon Musk or someone else would tell you that this was a hot coin you had to get, and you had to get it, you know, when it was minted. So I don't think it was just NFTs. There was always some new craze that you had to get involved in. And, you know, maybe you had to simp some star in order to get involved in that, you know, in that Discord channel and buy, I guess those are often NFTs. But yeah, there was always a new craze. And even if you kept up with one of them, there'd be a new one that popped up.
Pat, come on back in on the conversation.
Sure. Yeah, you know, one of the things I'm thinking about a lot with all of the really serious stuff happening now is that, you know, we've learned that markets can grow up faster than you can teach yourself how to think about them. Mm-hmm. And I think also faster than you can teach yourself how to emotionally handle them. You know, in the last 2 years in crypto, even for people who aren't investing in it, it's been something that has moved so fast that it just keeps you kind of like mentally and emotionally agitated. You know, I mean, I also kind of want to talk a little bit about sort of, you know, the people who are the partners in these situations and Joel, sort of like what they felt like they had to do to kind of get a hold of their relationships and really like bring their partners back from the brink.
Yeah, in almost every case, there was a guy, and it was almost always a young. It was always, in fact, we were looking all around. All we could find was young men, and the numbers in polls and kind of play this out. But it's a bunch of young men, and they get so wrapped up in this, and they think it's going to be a life changing moment that they can't miss out on. It's all FOMO, and that there's going to be generational wealth created for their grandchildren if they just stick to this one thing. And they all kind of were able to get their spouse, or more like their girlfriend, involved to an extent, but not as much as they would have liked. And then their relationships started to wither because they were so devoted to this one thing.
Yeah, Joel, I wonder if, you know, if these guys really are creating wealth through this, if that sort of changes the equation with the wives and girlfriends a little bit. Were any of these guys actually, you know, doing well with their trading enough to, you know, sort of get the day pass from their wives and girlfriends?
Sure. I mean, some of these guys, you know, on a exciting day could make $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, the guys I was talking to at least. And that goes a little, you know, a long way in convincing your girlfriend that it's okay you didn't go out with her this weekend. But, you know, those days were few and far between, especially as the market started to dry up at the beginning of this year.
I have to say, I loved, or didn't love, was it Candace, who was dating her boyfriend, and they're FaceTiming, and she becomes the really small box so that he can continue crypto trading?
Yeah, they're long distance right now. They're going to get married soon. But yeah, they FaceTime a lot, and he'd make her really small so that he can like check all his crypto stuff, and that would annoy her. But in a lot of these cases, eventually, either because of the crash or because of ultimatums, the boyfriends somewhat came around, and people were able to resolve their relationships in a lot of the cases where I talked to people.
So, Joel, what do you think happens if the crypto market takes off again? Are these guys incorrigible, or they learn their lesson? How do you see it playing out?
I mean, do you know any gamblers? They tend to be incorrigible. You know, I think there's hope that lessons were learned, but I think it's a very powerful draw.
Pat, get ready for like part two of this story, because I have a feeling, hi, my name is Igor, and it's coming. Fun to check in with you guys. Both have a great Thanksgiving, a safe one. Joel Stein, contributor to Bloomberg Business Week, joining us on the phone from Los Angeles, and Pat Regnier, he's markets and finance editor at Bloomberg Business Week. This story, by the way, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, and of course, always on the Bloomberg terminal.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We talk about a lot of theories when it comes to economics. There's supply-side economics, there's Keynesian, there's Marxism, there's new growth theory. I mean, Mike, there's a lot out there.
There's rockonomics, Carol. Did you know about rockonomics?
I have no idea.
This is a new one for me.
How come I didn't get to study that when I studied economics?
I'm
going
to go back to school and major in rockonomics.
Yeah, that wasn't a course option for me. All right, so there's lots of theories out there. I'm curious if any of you have heard about Swiftonomics. This is, as we said, among the most read on the Bloomberg. So let's get into it with Bloomberg News U.S. economy reporter Augusta Saraiva. She is U.S. economy reporter, as we said, here at Bloomberg News. She's joining us in our Interactive Brokers studio. Augusta, thank you so much for having us. Tell us about, first of all, how this came to be or came to your attention.
thank you so much for having me. And the reason why we decided to do this story is because last week I was one of the 14 million people who hit the Ticketmaster website.
Did you get tickets?
No, I did not get tickets. So now I'm left to deal with the secondary market and maybe try to get tickets for $45,000.
So how is this like an economic theory? Like, how do you think about that and put it into kind of, economic language?
Of course. Well, when you think about economic theory, I feel like two of the most basic concepts are supply and demand, right? But in Swiftonomics, that's completely upside down. That's an environment where you have skyrocketing demand, you have limited supply, at the same time you have monopoly accusations, you have accusations of price gouging. So it's a place where economic laws just don't apply, or maybe they do apply, but they're just completely out of this world.
Yeah, and Carol, for our generation, I think we experienced this with Bruceonomics earlier in the year could get a Bruce Springsteen ticket. But talk to me about, Augusta, that notion of elasticity of demand. You know, the classic economic theory is that as prices go higher and elastic good, the demand goes down. That doesn't seem to be the case with Swiftonomics here, that people seem to be willing to spend any amount of money on a ticket. I mean, is that what's going on? And is there sort of...
Or any amount of their parents' money.
Right. Inelastic parental demand is a whole different category of economics. Right? But is it also part of sort of just this bottleneck of people wanting to catch up with what they missed over the pandemic when they were locked inside?
Yeah, I definitely talked to some Taylor Swift fans who weren't able to get tickets last week, and now they're willing to pay anything. I spoke to a fan who had been saving for 10 months. He had a $2,000 budget, and he was telling me, if I had to spend $3,000, I would. I've never seen this woman play live in my life. I've been saving throughout the pandemic, and I feel like that's just one example of something, as you mentioned, Bruce Springsteen. This is something that we're seeing in this post-pandemic world, right? You have a lot of pent-up demand, people who, in the case of Taylor Swift fans, they've been waiting to see her live for 4 years now, 5 years by the time she goes on tour next year. So you just have a lot of pent-up demand, people who haven't been able to go to concerts for a long time and now are just eager to go back to that life.
You know, we were just, Mike and I were talking with our TV colleagues on radio and TV about consumer debt. And, you know, you keep hearing that consumer balance sheets are strong, there's lots of money. I pulled up something from the New York Fed because Romain was kind of pushing back a little bit. He's like, I don't understand. You know, we're hearing about rising credit card balances. The 15% year-over-year increase in credit card balances is the largest in more than 20 years. This is coming from the New York Fed. They put out some data and release on November 15th. And you do wonder whether the roost will come, you know, okay, great, I got the tickets, but now it's on my credit card. And you do wonder whether, even though they want to do this, pent-up demand from pandemic, whether, you know, later on we're going to see it in rising credit card balances or continued rising credit card balances.
Of course. And I did talk to someone who, unfortunately, we weren't able to include in the story, but this person was able to get tickets in the primary market last week. So those weren't crazy prices, but still it was outside of this person's budget. And they were telling me, for the next month, I'm only going to be able to buy groceries.
Wow.
Oh my God. Crazy. Hashtag crazy.
And you know what's fascinating is it's not a short tour. It's 52 days. Yep. That's a very long tour. So she seems to be, putting herself out there as much as possible. Big arenas, a lot of dates. Any chance you think she'll add some more dates?
Well, hopefully. that would be good for me. But and we sort of allude to that in the story, the sense that she's the sort of supply mastermind. At the end of the day, everyone's blaming Ticketmaster because of some of the issues. But at the end of the day, it's the artist who decides how many concerts they're adding, how many places they're going to. And in this case, she's added 17 new concerts since the tour was first announced at the beginning of the month. So she's trying to work on the supply side, but the demand is just, as I said, at this point, for some people, it's nearly inelastic.
She's good at whipping up a frenzy, though. I'm just going to put that out. Krista Sariva, thank you so much. U.S. economy reporter at Bloomberg News. Check out her story at Bloomberg.com.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day.
Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, we've got just about 10 minutes, just under 10 minutes left in today's trading session, getting ready to wrap up the trade ahead of the Thanksgiving Day holiday. Markets, remember, equity markets open on Friday again, but a shortened holiday session. Let's get to it, though, with Jennifer DeSisto. She's Chief Investment Officer at the registered financial advisory firm Anchor Capital Advisors. They've been managing money for nearly 40 years. They've got $7.6 billion in assets under management. Jennifer joining us via Zoom from Boston. Jennifer, good to have you here with Mike and myself. Let's talk about the tone, if you will. Not the tone of your computer. It happens. It's Zoom. But kind of the tone in the trade right now. It seems, you know, that there's an ability for investors, even though it's a light trading volume, to continue to take on risk. The FOMC minutes, does that support that trade in your view?
Yeah, there's opportunities out there. I think, you know, we've seen a pretty steady decline in the markets this year. And I think what we're seeing is that, you know, the Fed is getting closer to the end, which for us is a good sign of an opportunity to kind of step in and buy some stocks at this point. We think that there's a number of areas in the market that are down pretty significantly this year that present great opportunities for us to buy.
Yeah, Jennifer, I'm wondering, you know, the debate all year has been this sort of resurgence in the value stocks or the cyclical, you know, companies really tied to the economy, you know, at the expense of growth, high tech, you know, less profitable sort of hopes and dreams type of growth stocks. How are you thinking about the leadership for the rest of the year and next year? Is it as simple as, you know, the growth factor versus value factor? Or are you thinking about sectors? You know, how are you sort of positioning for what's coming?
Yeah, I mean, we're thinking about sectors. I think there's, you know, we've really kind of seen this transition, sort of what we saw in the 01 to 02 time period, where, you know, the technology valuations came down significantly, and we kind of rotated into this stretch of time for value stocks and value sectors like energy, industrials, materials. And I think because there's been such an underinvestment in that space for the last decade, there's a real opportunity over the next several years where we're going to see those companies do a lot better. We're also really interested in industrial companies that are supporting the, you know, secular drivers in renewable energy and electric vehicles. We're not directly participating in electric vehicles, but the more hyper growth plays in renewable energy. But there are a number of industrial companies that make components and sensors and connectors and in substrates and that go into these types of renewable energy plays. So we think those are really interesting opportunities. And we think in the mining and materials sector, there's opportunities as well. We're going to be needing, copper and lithium to be put into electric batteries. So we think that companies in that space who have actually done a lot on environmental and social concerns are really set up well for the next several years.
And I don't know how much deeper we can go in terms of specific names. You are talking sectors, but you did talk about old economy stuff and you mentioned industrials. What about something like the ag economy? You know, you've got Deere with some outperformance today and rallying in a big way.
Yeah, I think, we're going to be set up well in the agricultural space. I think, companies like Deere, as well as some of the kind of the seed companies we've looked at and own in our portfolios are doing really well. I think the shortage coming out of Ukraine and Russia really puts pressure on the food supplies globally. And so I think there's an opportunity there for companies in the ag sector to perform well in this environment.
Jennifer, how about the bond market? You know, obviously we've seen this huge increase in yields, both in treasuries and corporates this year. Is there enough competition now from the bond market to sort of make you allocate a little bit more heavily to fixed income than you would have otherwise?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of track where treasury yields are at versus the S&P 500 dividend yield. And we're clearly well above that level for the 10-year treasury at this point at over 3.7%. And so we think the bond market's actually at very attractive levels from a yield perspective. And also, you rarely see an instance where you have back-to-back negative years in the bond market. So we think it's really set up well for the bond market to kind of rally back here and also get some yield from both treasuries as well as investment grade corporate bonds.
Jennifer, you mentioned mining and materials. You also, you mentioned, renewable energy space. What about, the old integrated oil? Energy is still your top performer this year. If you look at the major industry groups in the S&P 500, that's after a banner year, the year before. Like, it has just been on a tear. We get the reasons why. Would you be committing new money to, basically fossil fuels at this point?
I would. I think on these pullbacks that we're seeing in the energy space, I'd be adding money. I think there's, a lot of these energy companies have transformed themselves. They become very cash flow conscious and very shareholder friendly, which I think is a real positive. They aren't drilling as much, but the drilling that they're doing is very profitable. And so from a stock perspective, we think that the energy space and, the integrated oil companies are attractive stocks at this point.
Jennifer, I know no one likes to try to time the market. I'm sure you don't either, but I'm just curious how you're thinking about this tremendous rally we've seen off the lows in October. S&P 500's up almost 13% from that low in October. Was that the quote unquote low, capital THE, or could there be another one to come? What do you think?
I think we still have a little ways to go. Usually when we have the inversion of the yield curve, it signals a recession coming at some point. So we're kind of anticipating, that there will be a point early, to mid next year that we'll see some recession. I think what we're kind of looking at in these short-term rallies is opportunities to kind of lighten areas that have really worked well and kind of set up well for have cash to redeploy when the market does ultimately bottom. We just haven't seen kind of earnings really come down yet, and which really kind of marks the bottom of marks kind of the recession starting. So we're really just being very patient at this point and just think that we probably have a better opportunity in next year.
All right, we're going to run. Hey, listen, have a great Thanksgiving. Jennifer DeSisto, thank you. Chief Investment Officer at Anchor Capital Advisors, $7.6 billion in assets under management, joining us via Zoom.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us live on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take.
Do you love Elon Musk? Do you hate Elon Musk? Do you have no idea what to think about Elon Musk? Then we have just the show for you.
He's become even more larger than life.
Buying Twitter doesn't get us closer to Mars.
They are like really close to the edge of like everything falling apart.
Like, oh, Elon, I volunteer, put a chip in my brain.
Each week on this podcast, we'll break down, analyze, and debate the most important stories on Musk and his empire.
It's all one big universe. You just work for Elon Inc.
From Bloomberg Businessweek, this is Elon Inc. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.